Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/book-versus-movie. There are over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Thanks so much.
Hello and welcome to Book Versus Movie. This is a podcast where we read books that have been adapted into movies, and then we try to decide which we like better, the book or the movie. I am Margot P. of ColoniaBook.com, and this is my good friend and co-host, Margot D. of Brooklyn Fit Chick.
Hi, everyone.
It's summer.
Yep. Summer.
We tend to do summer blockbuster type movies during the summer. We neither one of us are fans of summer. It's not my favorite, I have to say.
I not like it by you. Margo's on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast.
It's and better yes, here, I must admit.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm Margot P. on the West Coast, and Margot D. is on the East Coast of the United States, if you're joining us from abroad. And today we are going to be discussing H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds. But in case you are new to Book Versus Movie, we'd like you to know about several places on the internet where you can interact with us and other listeners of this podcast.
We do have a basic Facebook page. We post all the episodes there, so be sure to like it. But we also have a Facebook group. And if you're into Facebook groups, ours is pretty cool because we really do just talk about books and movies there. And we get a lot of great suggestions there. Just type in Book vs. Movie Podcast Group and ask to join. It is a private group. We are also on Twitter at Book vs. Movie and Instagram Book vs. Movie. And in those cases, you spell all those words out. We have an email. If you want to send us an email, it's Book vs. Movie Podcast at gmail.com. We just got in some new stickers and we have some other swag if you're interested. So please, if you could reach out to us via email and send us your address, we'll drop them in the mail for you.
We also have an Audible affiliation. This is a great book to listen to on Audible.
There's so many great Audible selections just for this title alone. And you go to audibletrial.com/book-versus-movie. I love Audible. I just love audiobooks. It's such a great way to take in the material sometimes, and they're just offering a free month to try it out for yourself. Once again, that's audibletrial.com/book-versus-movie.
And maybe you've been with us for a while and you like to keep us in books and movies around here. maybe you can support us on Patreon.
Yes, we've been doing this show for 6-7 years now. Who knows? It's been a long time. But we have a bunch of episodes up on our Patreon wall. We have a couple of very affordable options. A lot of places, podcast apps, including iTunes and the other ones that are out there, usually only keep up to about 100 episodes. Maybe they go back 2 years. So that's why we started putting a bunch of them up on there. And a lot of great summer movies are up there. I believe Jaws is on our Patreon page. We have a couple. Just go to P-A-T-R-E-O-N, look up Book Versus Movie Podcast. And also we have some stuff there that's free. So just go check it out if you're interested. You want to throw a few bucks. Also, if money's tight, and believe me, we totally get that. Just tell a friend about the show or leave us a 5-star review in iTunes. That would be amazing.
We really do appreciate everybody's support. You guys have been so great over the years. We really do enjoy hearing your suggestions and your thoughts on the books and movies that we cover. And again, I do feel that I should mention, because we are going to be talking about H.G. Wells and we are going to be talking about Steven Spielberg and we are going to be talking about The War of the Worlds, we are not scholars of books or movies or science. Nope. We are strictly from Amateursville, especially when it comes to something like this. And we also, neither of us really like science fiction type buffs. So we are really approaching. So if you, what I'm saying is, like, if you're a big, you know, science fiction fan, H.G. Wells fan, we're going to probably drive you nuts over the next, you know, however many minutes. But if you are interested in listening to the takes of a couple of total outsiders, you are in the right place.
Yeah, that's basically what it is with the show. We kind of come little mini experts on a thing, and it could be everything from a magazine article to a song to a novella to a novel. Now, we understand there's certain authors out there, like Mr. Wells, that people spend their entire careers, academic careers. Not only that, but then people go into science because they like him so much, and then they have those big careers. We understand. Please, you know, be gentle. We just kind of come at it like we put out a new show every week, especially since COVID. But we've actually liked quite a few science fiction stories.
We have. I mean, for people who are not, you and I are not science fiction-y kind of people,
right. We've
had some really good episodes, usually listener-suggested episodes that are science fiction-based. And I think this will be no exception. I just wanted to say, throw that in there, because yes, Wells is a Wellsian type figure.
Wells and Wells are that we'll be talking about.
Yeah.
And Spielberg.
And there's a lot of stuff we're going to miss. I didn't even get all the way through it, I have to tell you, full disclosure. I was watching this fascinating biography of Wells, kind of long, kind of lengthy. Of course, I didn't know any of this stuff, and really interesting life story. But I was listening to it thinking, like, oh, man, there's no way we're going to be able to cover all of this. It's a lot.
Well, we'll give you just the flavor of it. H.G. Wells, let's go for it. He was born Herbert George Wells, September 21st, 1866, in Kent, England, from pretty basic circumstances. He wasn't raised wealthy at all. He's definitely a person who kind of worked his way up in society to become the great writer that he is. He is a novelist. He was a teacher. He was a journalist. Got into teaching because he wanted to learn more. And so teaching offered him an opportunity to be around really wise people. And he just loved science. And that was something
I can offer an interesting thing that I learned about him was that his parents did not really care about him going to school, like, really thought that that was a waste of time and that what he really needed to do was to be an apprentice. And so they kept putting him in these apprenticeships, mainly in the textile industry, in what's called the drapery industry, but it's not just like curtains. It's a lot of stuff. And he hated it, begged to be allowed to leave these apprenticeships. And the parents were always like, no way. But the thing was, as a student, he was really a whiz kid. I mean, he really kind of blew the minds of his teachers, you know, in the amount of schooling that he had. He could commit things to memory really quickly. He could understand really complicated theories and concepts really easily, better than the teachers sometimes. And so one of his former teachers, and he really loved learning. He really wanted to be an academic. One of his former teachers kind of never forgot him and tracked him down as he was doing this apprenticeship and was like, listen, you know, I could really use a teacher's assistant. How about, you know, he talked the parents into allowing H.G. Wells to be this guy's teacher assistant. And then the the teacher basically like exploited Wells a little bit, entered him in these contests and like, you know, scholastic kind of things for profit.
Wow.
Yeah. But because H.G. Wells was such a, you know, a sponge and so wanted to learn, you don't really get a sense that he was so resentful of it, at least not anything that I found. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was really, really loved learning and really loved, it seems, the academic life, not the least of which, not the reasons of having to do with proximity to beautiful young lady students.
Yeah, he liked the ladies and the ladies liked him. He was, I don't know where to go with it. We should say some of his famous stories are The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, The War of the Worlds, The Island of Dr. Moreau. There's a couple of crazy movies based on that insane story. He started teaching once again because he wanted to be in a learning environment. That was just the best place for him. He was, his mind was like a sponge. He also would be writing things and thinking about things. And he understood, he got more and more into organizations that were about teaching and science. The more he did that, the more he got interested in society and how people react to systems and how they react to science. And he started writing when he was married to his second wife, and he was in Woking for a while. And if you go to Woking in Surrey, you will find structures of tripods and other kinds of things devoted to him. He's sort of like the...
And a fabulous Pizza Express, I'm told.
Oh, really?
That's a very stale joke for our UK listeners. Yes, that's for those of you in the U.S. who maybe don't know that story. That's where Prince Andrew was when he that was his alibi.
Oh, OK. I pretended I understood. Oh, no. But that's where he. Oh, boy. When he was really with. Oh, my God. That creep.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting is, you know, Wells is such an interesting mind, you know, really not just for science, but for
humanity in the future.
Humanity and the classicism that he saw, or is that the right word? You know, in Victorian society, he was a real critic of it. And, you know, in the meanwhile, you have Darwin. And one of his teachers was a great champion of Darwin by the name of T.H. Huxley, who was the grandfather of Aldous Huxley.
Oh, my goodness. I also, he was interested in socialist causes, and one of his paramours was Margaret Sanger, the woman that started Planned Parenthood. I mean, he's just lived a hell of a life. In 1946, he was writing right up until the end of his life. He actually wrote a screenplay towards the end of his life around 1938, 1939. Predicting World War II, which one could say everyone saw it coming too, but he really kind of saw how the effect it would have on England and the rest of the world. Thinking Winston Churchill was influenced by Wells and read a lot of his work, maybe didn't take it all in, but he certainly, he was a big force on the culture. And as I said, he was fascinated by science. He was completely interested in how it can help mankind or it could hurt mankind, and just what is a person and you know, what makes a good person or a bad person? Can you change things? And he thought of things like heat rays way before that they were actually invented. And nowadays he talks, like with the Island of Dr. Moreau, where people putting sheep and animal and humans together, that's really was a thing that was happening. And it's with these horrible animal experiments, but that he thought that he was scared what science would do. He predicted the nuclear bomb, that was it Fat Man and Little Boy? Is that what it's called? Those two big bombs. He predicted that and what it would do to people once they had this kind of power. He was interested in how things worked, how people responded to it, how it could change a society, but he was also worried about what was going to happen in the future.
I'm really such a mind, you know, for science and for humanity and how those two things interplay and how it can go well or not. I don't know that I'd ever read The War of the Worlds before. I read The Time Machine. I definitely read The Invisible Man. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I'd ever read The War of the Worlds. And what kind of blows my mind about it, that this is, it paints a landscape that is so, you don't want to say reminiscent because it hadn't happened yet, but so prescient of World War I.
Yeah.
And the impact of World War I and those, you know, flying attacks from the air and submarines and, you know, how crazy that must have felt to people. And of course, all of the devastation and death that happened, let alone in World War II. That's what I can't believe, is how accurately, you know, he kind of plays out these scenarios and how people would respond and what it would feel like to experience something like that at a time when it, you know, no one had. Mm-hmm. It's really quite something.
Yeah, it is. I haven't read it before either. My entry into this was the War of the Worlds, the radio drama. When I was a kid, I had that record. I was a weird kid. But that was my story, and that was my introduction to the story. I know I've seen the movie, and we're going to focus mostly on the film. But let's talk about the basic story. I mean, it takes place in England, basically in the countryside. There's a narrator who's not named. There's only one person that's given a name, right? That's Ogilvy.
Ogilvy, I think, is also, yes, I think that's correct. So the narrator, and again, what's very interesting about that is he's setting it, you know, to a contemporary reader or a Victorian reader, mm-hmm. you know, he's setting it in a place that people would have been very familiar with, the suburbs, if you will, of London, you know, this kind of more pastoral, we put a little picture of the landscape in the Facebook group. So you can see what it looks not different from that now. The way what he describes looks just like what's in that picture. Fields of grass and mm-hmm. such and such, little bridges. And then going into the big city of London, it's something he's talking about things that people would have had a great, great familiarity with. And it kind of, even now, oddly, being in the United States and reading it in the 21st century, it still kind of pulls you in that way.
It does.
Really interesting.
Yeah, there's this attack of aliens, of Martians on England. People don't know how to respond. People try to run away. I think it's illustrated really well in the Steven Spielberg movie, which we'll talk about more, but like the tripods having these long tentacles.
They are so scary sounding.
Yeah, 150 feet high, super, yeah, long tentacles that they could just get to people. And, so
and it's a pre-skyscraper world, we should say,
yes,
in this case.
And trying to picture that going through a field, too, of just like grass and sheep and just like little houses in England. The narrator tries to basically get away as any way he can. He separates from his wife for a little while, and then he meets other people as he goes. For a while, he's underground, and he becomes friends, with people who are underground, who are like, well, this is going to be happening. You know, I've known about this forever.
Yeah, this is how we live now.
This is how we're going to live. And I knew this was going to happen.
We're going to be mole people from here on out.
We're going to be, yeah, exactly, mole people until we fight back. And then he's like, yeah, I don't want to be so much of that. And eventually he goes back to, he finds his wife again, I believe. They reunite.
Yeah. So at the very, I mean, we're skipping ahead. There's a lot of devastation and destruction. And basically the Martians destroy, melt, kill mm-hmm. everything familiar to a Victorian English person. You know, anything that they would have loved or known, Wells destroys in this book via the Martians. It's just fascinating.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you think about the Blitz, and it sounds so much like people's experiences during the Blitz. And it predates it by half a century.
Years, yeah.
Yes. The Martians, we should say, spoiler alert.
Yes. Spoiler. We spoil the details.
For all of man's guns and mm-hmm. tanks and whatever he had available during the Victorian era, all useless against the Martians, but they were not prepared for our bacteria.
Our pathogens.
Have you ever read the pathogens? Have you ever read, it's called something like We Contain Multitudes?
No.
Have you read that book? It's a recent book, and it's about a very difficult book to read because it's about the millions and squillions of little tiny organisms that live on your body.
Oh, no, thank you.
And how they basically tell you what to do and how to feel. It's really creepy.
Oh, no.
And true. That's ultimately what defeats the Martians. Nothing man can do.
Right. That they just couldn't survive it here.
Yeah. So the Martians all die. There's only a few people left. And our narrator's like, well, I guess I'll go home, see what's left. So he goes home, and some of his house is still there. And he like, oh, man, this looks real bad. And he walks in, and he's looking around like, wow, I can't believe I was in this place, you know, concerned about my dumb life 2 days ago or however long it was. And he hears a noise and a strange voice behind him. And it's his wife, who is amazingly still alive. And they try to, you know, and again, it's about the persistence of life mm-hmm. too, how life continues to go on in spite of tragedy and loss and devastation. And, you know, it kind of ends with them kind of walking off into the sunset, trying to figure out like, how, first of all, how are we still alive? Wow. And we're just going to have to figure this out now.
Yeah.
Here we go. Let's go. And that's the book.
And that is
great. It's written so well, so compelling and accessible. I loved it.
There are great versions on Audible, too. I really liked listening to it. It's a fascinating story, and it inspired lots of people to be scientists. His work, like I said, inspired people, and that's prescient about human politics, human beings, and how they behave under stress. And it's very British, you know, they're just going to keep on and carry on and go home and get some tea.
They really do. I mean, I'm sorry. I can't imagine anybody in my family reacting. Let alone me, the way that he's like, oh, okay, I guess that's blown up now. I'll go this way then.
I'll go by boat over here. Oh no, then I met the mole person. Like, yeah, I better go home. It looks like they've all died. Okay, should we go to the 38 drama?
There's a lot of so many brilliant choices in Wells's work that obviously have inspired a lot of people to make their own adaptations of this book. I think the greatest one to me, and the reason why both the 1938 drama and the movie that we're going to talk about works so well, is placing the events in a very kind of ordinary, familiar, modern day, today setting of the time.
Yeah.
In 1938, we're talking about New Jersey.
It was Orson Welles. He was a rising star. He and John Houseman were big acting, producing stars in New York City. He had a weekly radio program. And it was against Candace Bergen's father. What was his name?
Edgar.
Edgar Bergen. And he had a dummy that
Charlie McCarthy versus the Martians. Yes.
Yeah. And that was a bigger show than the CBS Mercury Theater. That did better ratings. Somebody gave him the idea to do it. And they said, I'm sure Wells didn't even read it or just skimmed it. Like, because Wells just kind of liked doing his own thing. But they decide first to have it take place in America. And they take a dart and throw a map. You know, just throw it at a map and it lands in this Grover's Mills, New Jersey, which is near nowhere. And it's still near nowhere. It's not a cosmopolitan.
No. And the movie kind of pays a nice little homage to that part of New Jersey. Yeah. And in 1938, you know, when we were in the height of, will we enter World War II? Well, gosh, this Hitler guy seems pretty bad. Like, if we're not going to enter for this, like, what are we doing? It was a very heightened time in our history.
There's a lot to be said. There's people who say that it's overblown because they do this drama and we'll talk more about the actual performance, but the reaction to it was some people thought it was real and they freaked out. And then the thing to do now is to go back 50 years plus and say, weren't those people stupid? Are people so dumb? But to get more context, I was looking at, it was a PBS documentary that somebody recommended, and it was just about this particular program. And for a couple of years, people were used to news bulletins about really terrible things.
Yes, especially in 1938.
Yeah.
You know, when everybody is getting all of their information from the radio.
Yeah.
Not everybody, first of all, not everybody reads. Secondly, not everybody gets a newspaper, but many, many people do have a radio, or they, you know, even communities where you had homes without radios, they would gather around, you know, around the news hour, prime time, what we would say now, to hear the radio together with your neighbors and friends. And yeah, I think, you know, what you hear when you listen to that recording is a very convincing news broadcast style radio drop. Like, he is really... they're really giving it their all to make it sound like a real for real news bulletin.
We now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side. It's studying the object while the captain and two policemen advanced with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute. Something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the fires, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission. However, we will return to that point at the earliest opportunity. In the meantime, we have a late bulletin from San Diego, California. Professor Indelkoffer, speaking at a dinner of the California Astronomical Society, expressed the opinion that the explosions on Mars are undoubtedly nothing more than severe volcanic disturbances on the surface of the planet. We continue now with our piano interlude.
Well, it was a 1 year or 2 years before the Hindenburg crashed, which was this blimp in the middle of New Jersey, mind you.
Yes. Yes. Also in New Jersey. And you can, whenever I see that Hindenburg footage, I always think about, what must that have been like to hear on the radio? Because most people would have heard it on the radio.
Right.
First of all, there's a giant balloon in the sky. Wait, no. It's so giant. There are people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, and it's filled with explosive gas. Yeah. And
it's a Zeppelin.
And it's held together by cow skins. And now it's exploded in a giant fireball in New Jersey. What?
And the Nazis had them. They used to fly to the U.S. with these. I mean, I'm not kidding. They would have Nazi symbols on them. I've heard from older people in my neighborhood in Brooklyn that would talk about that. Like the people that escaped from Europe would get terrified when they'd see these blimps because it reminded them of Hitler. So this happens, and there's Oh the Humanity, that's a very famous vocal, not performance, but reaction to what was happening. They still have that to this day. You could still get it. It's still visceral. It still is terrible.
And what's interesting, I think, is where with Wells's version, like Wells's version is very much a commentary, a deliberate commentary on British imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would it feel like if somebody invaded the British? Yeah, you go over to, you're going into all these other countries and taking over their land and their people and their governments and subjecting them to our government. What if that happened to you? How would that feel? Orson Welles takes that and turns it on its head, kind of exploiting Americans at a time where they were very afraid of being invaded. It had never really happened before, mm-hmm. and it was a real possibility. And just totally turning the dial all the way up to 10 on that.
It's brilliant.
Very much on purpose.
Oh, yeah. The show is on Sunday nights, and I think they said they finally approved the script like late Saturday night. He was one of those famous people to like get everything going till the very end, but he was very specific about how he wanted it to sound. He wanted it to sound just like any other radio program, and then all of a sudden, all hell goes loose. There's a reporter, and he's just talking about something going on in Jersey, and then all of a sudden, he sees these Martians and they're landing and what is going on here? And you hear people screaming and the reporter's trying to keep up. And the brilliant thing he does is that he just cuts the audio for like 20 seconds.
It's chilling.
And it's really freaky. Like you believe it's really happening. And then it comes back and then you hear people screaming and yelling in the background. And it sounds like they probably really were screaming and yelling, just to get the right sound.
And the thing to remember is, I mean, we were sort of making fun of it earlier, but Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy was the equivalent of must-see TV.
It was very popular.
Everybody watched it. So what happened, if you've ever listened to the audio of the War with the Worlds broadcast, they tell you in the very beginning, mm-hmm. this is the, we're going to be doing an adaptation of H.G. Wells. Da, 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 da. They never say it again. So a lot of people are listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and they do what we all do, like today with television. When the commercial comes on, you start flipping. They're listening to Edgar Bergen, I don't know who their sponsor was. They go to a commercial and people are like, oh, let's see what's on the other station.
Right.
And they turn the dial. So not knowing
right
what it is at all. And yeah, if you didn't hear the little teeny disc, like the, I don't know, probably less than a minute, the little tiny thing at the beginning that tells you that this is a radio adaptation of the H.G. Wells, da 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 da. For all you know, Martians have invaded.
And if you know New York, where rational brain is going, and you and I lived on the East Coast. I'm from the East Coast, but you lived there for a while. I know how long it takes to get from central New Jersey to Newark versus to get to Manhattan. To get from Battery Park up to Times Square is a certain amount of time. I mean, they're talking very rapidly, like in 30 minutes. Like, this is really, they got a lot of information in 30 minutes.
Time. Yeah, they move real fast.
They move real fast. I love it. And my favorite part is like one part they, I think it's Ogilvy, there's a professor from San Diego who says, it's no big deal. It's just some sunspots. Don't worry about it. But no, it's these Martians, they're taking over the world. And first it sounds like a news program. Then it kind of cuts off and then they play it. And it's the music that's from Psycho. Who was the?
Bernard Herrmann.
He did the music here. And it's really good. And they go to these piano concertos and then they come back. And then there's this great part where Wells himself, who was a wonderful actor and he had a fantastic voice.
What a voice.
Oh,
what a voice.
I mean, and just good looking and brilliant and apparently a real pain in the ass. But I mean, a lot of brilliant people are. But he's playing this person that's like, now the world's been devastated. I'm just going to walk around and figure things out. And you have to understand, like, there's a lot happening in 40 minutes, like in the time. But you're believing it. But it sounds so real. Like he starts talking to a dude who starts going crazy, like, you know, this is going to happen. And he kind of gets away from him. And then we find out that they're dying, that the invaders are dying, that we're going to be okay. But it's going to be a little different, but we're going to figure it out. Don't be afraid anymore. And then Wells comes in and goes, well, this was my little pre-Hollywood boo to you. I hope we scared you, but it was just a little scary thing. Don't worry about it. Bye.
Meanwhile, people have like abandoned their homes.
Some people did. I mean, is it really the biggest freak out? Who knows? The media loves to report on itself.
I would argue no.
Yeah.
I would argue that seeing as how our capital was just invaded by people who believed all kinds of interesting theories.
You know what?
This seems quite tame.
Yeah.
But I can totally understand how. First of all, it's designed so brilliantly to create exactly that impression. Mm-hmm. And all it takes is for you to miss the first minute of the broadcast to be totally sucked in.
And you're dealing, and if you're listening with a bunch of other people and they start getting worried, and do we know someone in Jersey? Maybe we should call them. The phone lines were all jammed. There was somebody who put a clip in our Facebook group. There was AT&T workers that took the calls because you used to call a switchboard. They didn't have 911.
Those poor women.
Yeah. And they're like, okay, I don't think we're being invaded, but we'll find out. You know, it's a remarkable amount of destruction happens in a certain number of minutes. The next day was a Monday, and that actually was Halloween. And all of a sudden it was the front page, you know, in the morning. And then they used to have afternoon papers. And so Wells had to give a press conference, guys. And he didn't like that so much. He loved it. He loved the controversy. And it got people saying, like, Congress, you should do something about this because the media is scaring people. Do we need to put a ratings on this? What do we need to do? And Wells is sort of going, I didn't know it was going to happen. I'm so sorry, but
I said it was an adaptation.
Yeah,
we told you it was for Halloween.
It was for funsies. What are we even talking about?
I can't help it if you were listening to Charlie McCarthy instead of me.
A ventriloquist dummy was like the most popular show. It's the
a radio ventriloquist.
Yes.
And he's brilliant and hilarious, by the way. I mean, I love Edgar Bergen. I think he's so funny. I used to love him on The Muppets.
Oh, yes.
Remember?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's great. It's great. I no longer find it so implausible that people
no
bought it.
No.
I used to think it was implausible. I no longer think that.
It used to be kind of funny. It was like, oh, look, those yokels from the 1930s. They didn't, you know, they're not as smart as we are. They're not as savvy as we are. But when you listen to it, like I said, it sounds like the real thing, especially if you've heard other broadcasts before. It sounds like it. And it became, Orson Welles became a huge star. He went on to make brilliant things. There was a 1953 movie that I really enjoyed, and that's on Amazon streaming.
I remember that one. That one really scared me as a kid.
It was, yeah, very
scary. Really scared me.
And really good special effects for the time. And I think Steven Spielberg said he saw it as a kid and it terrified him and he loved it. And should we start going into the movie or?
Yes. I'm interested. I have some things I have to say about this movie.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
Okay, so let's play the trailer. This is the 2005 trailer.
I need you back in 4 instead of 12. I got half a career coming in.
I can't.
You know what your problem is?
I can think of a couple of women be happy to tell you.
8:30?
We said 8 o'clock.
Hello, Dad.
Hello, Rachel.
We'll be back by 9:30 on Sunday.
Mom says you got a report due on Monday.
What do you know, right?
Everything.
Rachel, want to see something cool?
Lightning doesn't strike twice.
You believe this, Ray? Every single car.
Oh, I never see that many strikes of lightning in one spot.
You feel that?
There's something down there, and it's moving.
Normally, I pull a lot of clips, but much like Fast and the Furious, which we did last week. Yeah, it's just lots of crashing and sounds. Not scintillating dialogue going on here.
And Dakota Fanning screaming.
You know what?
She's a good screamer. I don't need to hear her scream ever again.
No. There's a lot of Dakota screaming going on here. This movie is a big hit. Steven Spielberg had worked with Tom Cruise before in Minority Report, which is a movie that people want us to, because I think it's based on a Philip K. Dick novel. They hit it off. This is post 9/11, by the way. So the first few years.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So you and I were both in New York for that.
We
and
weren't
the movie
at the
came out.
Trade Center. We were.
No, I was in Brooklyn Hospital, so I saw a lot of people, thousands of injured evacuees. Mm-hmm. I was probably I think the closest I got was a half a mile, but even then, like my throat was all like scalded,
I worked in Times Square. I was working at Condé Nast, and I walked home over that bridge.
I was in Brooklyn, and I walked to the Weehawken ferry and took which is a long walk, mm-hmm. and then took the ferry across and found somebody took me home from there. I don't even know who it was. What I'm trying to say is 2005, too soon. Even for me now watching it, too soon. It's too soon. And then the other thing that I forgot, I had seen this movie. I think I saw it when it came out. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I forgot, and I couldn't remember anything about this movie at all. And now I know why. It's because one, it was way too soon. Way too soon for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you. And two, my dad had just died.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I was, you know, I walked in like, oh, I'm going to go see this fun movie. And I remember now that it like super upset me. And it's not a bad movie. I'm not saying at all that it's
totally
me.
No, those.
It's totally me and the baggage that I'm bringing into the theater.
Yeah.
But even now, it was super hard for me to watch. It was very difficult for me to watch this movie. Did you have that experience at all?
Not as much. No, but I don't remember seeing it at the time. This is the first time I've seen it in a really long time. But there is sort of this delicate thing about the first few years after 9/11 happened. You know, people like to make these big blow 'em up movies. And when you blow up a place, nothing's more fun to blow up than New York, right? You got the Brooklyn Bridge, you get the Statue of Liberty, Empire State Building. I mean, it's fun to watch that. And it took me a long time to be able to watch those kind of things. So maybe I intuitively knew not to do that. When my dad died, the movie Inside Out came out. I know. And I was like, oh, 10 minutes into the theater running out. I just like, nope.
Sure. No, no, no.
No, 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 no.
Now, having said that, you know, I think this is Steven Spielberg we're talking about. You know, Schindler's List, and he may even have said this again. I'm not a film scholar of any kind. Mm-hmm. He may have even said at the time that he was trying to, you know, put that experience on film in a way that the general public could understand, not just the people who experienced it themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think he does that very effectively. The scene that most bothered me. Oh gosh, it's making me emotional just thinking about it.
Oh my God.
The scene that bothered me the most was when he comes back, Tom Cruise comes back in the house and he's covered with that ash.
Yeah, when he hits
and he's
his head.
Like catatonic.
Yeah.
I saw literally thousands of people that day.
Yeah.
Who looked like that. Thousands. Thousands. And so that was very hard. I'm getting emotional.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
But that's
so. Yeah. But I think it's good. I think he does a really good job. I mean, because how do you communicate that to people who don't experience it personally, right? I think it's really good. It was super hard for me to watch.
Right.
But I think that I think it's a very super good movie. I also think
I'm sorry.
I also think that it was unfortunate for Mr. Spielberg that his movie star at the time was I seem to remember something about him being in love with Katie Holmes.
I think they were dating around that time.
Was he in love with Katie Holmes?
Yes.
He might have mentioned it.
Okay, so the movie's filmed in 2004, and I think they stop filming in 2005. Like, that's when they start editing it. Somewhere around April or May, Tom Cruise is starting to do publicity, and he goes on the Oprah show, famously jumps over couches.
And Steven Spielberg was supposed to be there with him that day, and for some reason couldn't make
there.
It.
He literally dragged Katie Holmes. Remember that? He dragged her from backstage.
Yeah.
To the show. We all watched this.
It was just bizarre. Forget it was Oprah. Forget it was Tom Cruise. Think of someone in your life, someone you really like, you know, a close friend, a cousin, somebody, a sibling. Somebody you know, you want to see happy. Somebody you want to see them in a relationship, a loving relationship. And they come to your house for dinner and a chat. And you're like, oh, hey, how's the dating life? And they jump up on your sofa and jump up and down and say, I'm in love with Susie Smith. I'm in love with Susie Smith. And then they go into Susie Smith's house and drag her out and bring her into your living room.
And the audience was yelling, Katie, Katie. Like they were.
It's so weird.
He's so popular. Before this, he was so banal. Like he did not make big statements. He did what a movie star should do. He just was just anonymous enough with his private life.
Why it's so bizarre. Again, if anybody in your life did that in your house.
Yeah.
You would be so worried about them.
Any other celebrity. Yeah. This is crazier than anything that Britney Spears did. And they like put her in a conservatorship for 13 years. I mean, he really went nutty.
And I love Oprah's face, by the way.
Yeah. Years later, she's like, I think he was kind of using me. I'm like, you think? Perhaps. But he did. This is not it. Then he went on the Today Show with Matt Lauer, and he took a dump all over Brooke Shields for postpartum depression.
I forgot this. That was the same tour, wasn't it?
It was like it.
I totally forgot that.
Within a few weeks.
Matt, you're being glib.
Matt, you're glib. I mean, just ridiculous. Like, took his reputation and just put it in a fire. Like, maybe he was bored. I don't know. But he started doing the, and Spielberg is like, dude, we got a movie coming out. Maybe that's why I didn't go. I think, you know, maybe I was like, you know what?
I have to think.
And I like Tom Cruise movies.
But how would that help your movie? What was Mr. Spielberg? Why? I don't understand. Well, you know what? He was busy making his next giant movie. You know, there's lots of people involved in making those decisions about who's going to send Tom Cruise to Oprah. I'm sure they thought that was a great idea. Oh, Tom can handle it. No, we don't need Steven. No, Tom's got this. But why then after that would you?
Because I think his publicist was his sister. What? I think that was her job.
Really?
And she's at one. Anyway, we won't talk about the organization.
Well, that's a whole thing.
A whole other, whatever.
Oh, so I didn't know that, though.
Yeah. So that's a part of that. So he brought Katie Holmes to the red carpet for the first time at the movie's premiere. I mean, it was holy. So let's talk about the movie. Tom Cruise plays a guy named Ray, and he works for at a stockyard.
Okay.
Or longshoreman. Yeah.
How hilarious is Tom Cruise's idea of dad bod?
I like what Seth Rogen says about Tom Cruise. It's like he's really literally willing to kill himself to make a movie. Like, he's willing to die on camera. He's always doing stunts. He's always like doing these. He's so.
Does he get to run?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
He loves to run. He knows he's good at running. He knows he looks great on camera running. He plays a guy who's divorced. Miranda Otto plays his wife, and it was she was real psyched to get the part. I'm like, not great women parts here. I mean, just
no. And again, I mean, to be fair, the source material gives you nothing to go on.
And Wells was.
You know, the narrator in the book, you just know he loves his wife. I mean, that's all you're kind of told. You have no idea what kind of a guy he is or she, what kind of a woman she is. So yeah, they're divorced. I love her boyfriend with the turtleneck.
Yes.
By the way, it's such an like 90s D-I-C-K. but you don't ever really, a couple of things I don't understand about this marriage story that we're supposed to be, we don't get a lot of time to absorb. We don't really understand why they're not married anymore. Is it because she wanted to go with a slick yuppie? She didn't want to be with a working class guy? I don't know.
Right.
He doesn't seem to have any, like, she seems a bit posh. Her parents are clearly quite posh. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing that says that it's a class thing. There's nothing that says that he's like a hothead or we're not really given any, we're not given any reason why they would be together or why they would be apart.
No, she shows up and he's late picking up his kids. It's divorced dad weekend kind of thing. She's pregnant, Miranda Otto, the ex-wife. She's with her
turtleneck baby.
Turtleneck. I used to have a boss in the 90s. Dressed down Friday, he would wear a black turtleneck and jeans. And everybody's like, is he a cat burglar? Like, is he going to put on a ski cap and like, you know, what? So 90s. But this is 2005. I mean, it's still sort of like that leftover of what's going on. But Ray's, so his pregnant wife, Marianne, such a Steven Spielberg name, she and her now husband are going to go to her mother's place. They're going someplace, and Ray has the kids for the weekend.
Yeah, they're going to Boston.
Right.
To see her parents. And without the grandchildren for some reason?
Yeah, just
their grandchildren. That seems odd.
Yeah, I guess it's his weekend and he gets them and that's that. But he has Dakota.
So why would you schedule the grandparents' visit? I'm sorry, as a parent?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Because grandparents to contend with on both sides of our family. I don't see, like, my parents would be like, why are you even here?
Yeah. Well, she's pregnant. Maybe we don't know. That's his weekend. He noted that he's in Bayonne, New Jersey, and it looks very Bayonne. His home. I mean, I know I have friends from there.
It really does. I lived in that part of New Jersey, and it's apt.
Yes.
He captures it perfectly. Okay. Here's the next thing I don't understand. Why does he have a giant freaking house?
It's just
filled with antiques. where he lives by himself. It's a giant house.
Well, these movies always do that. They give them these huge homes that like make no sense. I'm always thinking of Gone Girl. You know, they have that huge McMansion.
Exactly.
It's just the two of them.
Exactly. So she goes on. He's moaning about he doesn't have any money. Like they can't, you know, first of all, if you weren't eating out all the time, how much more money would you have?
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. But secondly, like, why didn't you sell your super, super, super valuable? Like in the early 2000s, I sold my New Jersey home in the early 2000s. Let me tell you, I sold it for way more than we bought it for. So there's no way. Like, why wouldn't you sell that house and get you a little bachelor pad on the water? You could have a 3-bedroom apartment with a room for each of your kids. So they don't have to share a room. Why are they sharing a room in a giant house in New Jersey? I don't understand these things, Margo.
They're confusing. Very confusing. There's tension with the son. The son's pissed at him, and he and his daughter connect, and that's Dakota Fanning, who has the most expressive face ever. I mean,
Dakota Fanning at her Dakota Fanningest.
Just the Fanningest ever. I mean, just the screaming and the blue eyes. I mean, she just gets it down. She's got the, I like her little backpack that's always with her. She holds on to it.
I love her outfit.
Yeah.
Her little like rainbow bright outfit ensemble. She's great. I mean, she is the Drew Barrymore in E.T. of her generation.
Yes, definitely the Drew Barrymore. And Tom Cruise apparently went through 61 black jackets, the black leather jackets. I got to some of the trivia that I got. Anyway, there's a storm that's happening outside. Lightning is striking. And at one point he even says, you know, lightning never strikes in the same place twice. And the Martians, basically, they've been in the Earth for thousands of years, and they're coming up. So that's the difference.
That is so much scarier.
Yes, it's terrifying.
It's so scary.
It's super terrifying. So these are called tripods. They come out. That's what they're calling them. And he takes the kids out, and then Margo says, like, they're running through the streets, and basically these tripods start moving, and they're just laser shooting people and killing people. And what they do is they just eviscerate a person, like, right there until they're just dust. And there is that really phenomenal scene where it's the woman who's a friend of his, and he runs, like, basically just right through her. She's killed right away. And it's someone he cares about.
The effects are extraordinary.
Really good.
But it's really this, you know, the story that, you know, the Spielberg, I mean, he's so smart.
Yeah.
You know, to have them be underground, just like germinating and waiting in New Jersey.
In the basement.
So scary. Oh, gosh. But the, you know, that, yeah, that storm in the sky, again, that was very... You know, I'm sure you remember, like I remember, the column of smoke from Ground Zero.
It floated over my apartment for days.
It burned for like 3 weeks. It was burning.
The smell was everywhere.
So it was not unlike that moment in the movie. I think it's very well done. It was very hard for me, but I think it's a super good movie.
Yeah.
I love the scene with the, you know, the whole segment with Ogilvy.
Tim Robbins. So this is where, once again, and it's interesting, Ogilvy is from the original novel, the name anyway, but Tim Robbins, he plays a kook. He's a guy that's a misanthrope. He lives alone and he's got this ramshackle place. So Tom Cruise is running around with these kids. He's great at it. He's carrying Dakota Fanning. It's CrossFit, right? I mean, he's just carrying Dakota Fanning and running.
He's carrying that. And she's not a baby.
No, she's carrying like that 8 or 9.
Yeah. All over New Jersey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're trying to... Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, so I was going to say, one of the things I really liked, which terrified me, was the scene where they were in the car and then their car was surrounded by people. And then a guy put a gun to him and takes the car from him.
So scary.
It's terrifying. And then they get to the ferry and they're going to take the ferry out. And then that was super scary because the ferry...
Because they're in the water, too.
And it's like a few years after Titanic movie. I mean, it was like very reminiscent of that. The ferry flips over. I mean,
I was evacuated off the island on a ferry. One of the moment that I found, again, I had totally forgotten about this movie. Mm-hmm. Again, it's such an awesome Spielberg touch. Another one, yet another one, is the son's reaction, which was very much, especially, I so remember this. That, you know, for those of us living in New York City, and we were hearing from our friends and family who are not in New York City, like, we need to go get them. We're going to go. We're going to blow them. Like, I remember I was in grad school at the time when that happened. A friend of mine who was from Eastern Europe, you know, so she'd seen some stuff, right?
Yeah, sure.
And we were talking about that, like, you know, we were sharing stories like, yeah, my uncle in Wisconsin wants to, you know, blow up the Middle East now. And, you know, my parents, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, who are they going to blow up?
Right.
Like, who? This is such an underground, small, you know, but there's some people react that way.
Yeah.
That they just
want vengeance. Ugh. That's what they do, yeah, with their anger and their fright.
I loved that choice of having the son have that reaction. I thought was really, really smart.
They get to a part where they are in a park, and is it the mom and the husband, and they're going to take Dakota away?
Yeah, because Tom Cruise has gone after his son, who is determined to join these soldiers, and
he's begging him not to.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Dakota Fanning is waiting for him. She can see him and everything, but these people think that she's there by herself and are trying to take her. So
it's another people. Like, it's not her parents.
No, it's not her parents. Okay. So he sees like, oh my gosh, these people are trying to take my daughter and these people are trying to take my son. Like, what
do I do? Who do I pick?
I do. Yeah. I mean, that was great. I mean, there's a lot of really, I do think he did a really good job. I thought the adaptation was worthy of the source material. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, really telling a very difficult story to tell for people who didn't experience it personally. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember just having, I'm sure you had this experience too, like trying to explain it to people who weren't there. You know, like my husband was gone when that first happened. And he was in Europe. We had been in Europe and I came back and he got stuck there. And I was trying to tell him on the phone, like, it's gone. Like, the Trade Center's gone. And he was like, well, no, it's not gone. You know, there's something. I'm like, no. Like, it's like there's a hole in the ground that's on fire. Right. It's gone. Or, oh my gosh, the other scene that like really got to me was with all the flyers. Remember all the flyers that were everywhere, missing people?
I can't watch that.
No. Because that went on for weeks.
Weeks,
too,
you would take the subway, flyers. And it was terrible. Like every stop, every time the subway would stop at a subway stop, all the staircase on the side of the staircase filled with pictures. It was flyers of people. Have you seen this person? And I would do it too if you know.
There were a lot of people who lost touch with their family just because they'd been evacuated so quickly.
Right.
You know, people to Staten Island or whatever, and the you know a lot of. Our cell phone signal things had been on the Trade Center and you couldn't reach people. And so, yeah, that was really hard to see in the movie, but so smart of Spielberg to put it in there so people can understand, you know, that what it was like, what that was like to see that or what that was like to be that person that put that flyer up in your last ditch effort to try to find your family member or husband or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really well done. It's still too soon for me. But
I've never seen United good. Flight 90. Is that what it's called? 93?
Oh, no, I've never seen it either.
I won't. There's a lot of those I won't watch. We'll say at the very end, it's Tom Cruise's character. They get to Boston eventually. A lot of walking and running and.
Lots of walking and running.
But they get there, and then it turns out that the aliens are now disintegrating because they can't handle being in the Earth's atmosphere.
Hermesium.
Yes. Well, they were creating this vegetation. It's really gross. They were like drinking blood.
Oh, yeah.
Like people's blood. They were
and
creating
this like weed thing, this like red. Oh, it's so gross. I mean, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's such a brilliant choice, but it's gross.
It's super gross. But then, and the whole thing that we watch is like the birds and the bird patterns. And when he sees that spaceship at the very end, and then he realizes that the birds are flying around the ship now. And he's like, oh, their shield is, and it's good use of sound too, just like in the radio drama.
Excellent sound design in this.
Yeah, because he's screaming, yeah. And the guy's like, I can't hear you. What are you trying to tell me? And then in a good move, like he listens to someone giving him good information, whereas in most movies, that guy be like, ah, go away.
I know.
We got this.
I was
this.
Like, really? Really listened to him.
Yeah, he really took his advice. Well, the guy in the leather jacket, like, looked like he was what he was doing. Then Tom Cruise comes back and they're in Boston. But actually, Margo, they're in my neighborhood. They filmed that last scenes in Park Slope.
I went to college in Boston. Yeah. It's not in the... I mean, it's close. I get what we were going for here, but I'm sure anybody from Boston is like, yeah, that's not Boston.
No, it's
but it looks
Street.
Great.
It looks
it's
beautiful.
A cool house.
And we're with Miranda Otto. And
I'm sorry, were her parents like busy shopping in the J. Crew catalog while the Martians were attacking? What?
Not a speck of dust. But do you know who they are? They were the original people from the 1953 movie.
Were they?
Yes. So the
I didn't know that.
Anne Robinson was the grandmother. She played Sylvia Van Buren and I loved in the fifth the bangs she had in the
bangs.
Bangs. And then it's Gene Barry. He played Dr. Clayton Forster.
Yes,
I like that movie.
Course.
He treated her with a lot of respect. It wasn't very it was really cool. But anyway, they play the grandparents and they're just sort of like, hey, Tom Cruise, and he's carrying her home. And then Robbie comes down. Somehow Robbie survived. Robbie went up that hill. We thought he died in the fire. Nope, he found his way to Boston. And that's the movie.
I think it's super good. Like I said, bad timing for me, but a great movie. I think it's really good. I really enjoyed reading the book and then seeing that interpretation of it. I think is a very fun experience if you've never read the book. I think the greatest casualty is probably Oprah.
Oprah's couch.
I love her face. Okay. Her face, like,
okay, I'm gonna couch. Go. I'm gonna go along with this. He's the biggest star in the world. Okay,
but she has a slight like.
Huh?
I better get a new couch after this.
It was like 15 years ago. It took over the news cycle. He was doing something every day, though. It was just, you know, he really.
It was a weird.
Choice
but I had forgotten. I had completely see that goes to show you how much it did eclipse.
Yeah.
You know, I had completely forgotten that was because he was promoting this movie.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
He didn't do things like that before. Everything he did was to make Tom Cruise look cool. He didn't do a lot of interviews or, you know, he was married to Nicole Kidman for almost 10 years and they just went to red carpets as far as I know. Like they never did anything else and they adopted two kids and he kept everything really quiet. And then he had this relationship with Katie Holmes and it was bananas. Yeah. We're looking at each other right now and not saying anything because I don't want to get sued. They were in love.
Well, we can only say, I mean, it is a matter of public record.
Yeah, they got married.
He jumped on the sofa.
He jumped on the sofa and he insulted Brooke Shields and then invited her to his wedding. And then Leah Remini, and that's when Leah Remini got in trouble, was at their wedding. That's like started.
Oh, that's right. That I remember.
Yeah. Anyway,
yeah. So anyway, book versus movie. What do you think?
I'm going to say book because I super like the 53 movie and I love the radio drama. I put that in the Facebook group. I like this story. I really like the story.
I do too. I think we wouldn't have, I like all those adaptations. I love both of the movies and I love the Orson Welles. But what makes them great is all the stuff that Welles, all the choices that Welles made with that book. I mean, really genius choices on every level, the science level, the humanity level, the drama level, all the political level. Yeah, I will too, because I really did enjoy the book so much.
It's really worthwhile. You guys should definitely give it a go. What's also we're going to do next is going to be very fun. I don't know how the book is going to go over. I know I'm going to really enjoy this movie because we are covering next Legally Blonde.
That's right. Finally,
we're doing Legally Blonde. It's easily available to get on the Libby app. It's not expensive to get on Kindle. It's 175 pages, a pretty quick read. And I think the movie is having an anniversary. I keep reading stories about it. So I wonder.
I think so too. Yeah.
If it's a 15 or a 20 year anniversary. But Elle Woods is just an amazing character. I think she's fascinating. I love Reese Witherspoon, and I think it's going to be so much fun. And it's like seems like summer to me, all that pink. And Harvard, your husband went to Harvard.
That's right. We're gonna talk about that next time. I'm very much looking forward to that. Now, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at Brooklyn Fit Chick for Twitter and Instagram. My blog is brooklynfitchick.com. And Margo, where can they find you?
You can find me online at coloniabook.com, and all of my social media callouts are at She's Nacho Mama.
Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back soon with a new episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Book vs. Movie podcast. We are a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. You can find more podcasts you will love at frolic.media/podcasts. We follow the hashtags Lady Pod Squad and Pottering Family. If you want to support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, go to Patreon, and look for Book vs. Movie Podcast. We have a basic Facebook page, but we also have a private Facebook group. Go to Facebook and type in Book vs. Movie Podcast Group if you want to join that. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Book vs. Movie. Spell all those words out. If you'd like to send us an email, it's Book vs. Movie Podcast, spell that all out, at gmail.com. We do have a promotion with Audible. If you want to check out their service for free for 30 days, go to audibletrial.com/book-versus-movie. You can follow Margo D at Brooklyn Fit Chick on social media and Margo P at She's Nacho Mama. Thanks so much again for checking out our show, and we'll be back soon with a new episode.
You and me, I don't think we're on the same.